You can find a lot of people who will tell you that you can get clues to what people are thinking and clues to whether they're deceiving you based on where they are looking. For example, whether they're looking up and to the right or down and to the right and so on. Here's one common version of this idea.
Want to know when somebody's lying? It's all in the eyes. Now, there are exceptions to everything, but I've noticed this to be true in regards to myself and also other people that I deal with on a day-to-day basis. It's based off of your left and right brain hemisphere, and you looking in a certain direction could mean whether you are telling the truth and recalling a memory, or another direction where you're constructing something, you're making up something. Up and to the right, you're constructing a visual or a picture of something that you've never seen before. This person could be possibly lying if their eyes are going up and to the right. Straight to the right is imagined auditory. This person could also be lying, but they could also just be making up a tune, writing a poem, other things like that, but it's imagining auditory. Down and to the right is the same thing, but except for feelings. So you're recalling an emotion, imagining a feeling, imagining an emotion. Okay, next up, up to the left is you remembering a picture or image and recalling a scene witnessed. To the left is auditory again, but you're remembering a sound, you're recalling a tune previously heard, remembering a poem. Down and to the left is internal self-talk. This is when you're listening to the voice inside of your head and talking to oneself.
These eye direction ideas come from the world of neuro-linguistic programming, also known as NLP. Here's an image from the NLP training site where it labels someone looking up and to their left as remembering pictures and looking up and to their right as constructing pictures. The upper left and upper right idea is just one specific iteration of the more general claim that you can get reliable information of some sort about what someone is thinking by the direction of their eyes. There are other assorted variations on this, including some more subtle and nuanced seeming ideas. Here's a clip from the popular YouTube show Behavior Panel talking about using eye direction to get information. This was from the first Behavior Panel episode in 2020, in which they analyzed the behavior of Carol Baskin. Baskin was featured in the documentary Tiger King. Some people suspected she had killed her husband, which is why the show was examining her.
Point about eye movement, if you notice in every other place, go watch when she's describing her father building these cages and she's accessing and she's remembering it's four by and she's using data.
Yes.
And she's recalling her eyes are drifting right. She uses that as an illustrator as well. She'll make her points by doing this. This is the only time I see her eyes go to her left as she's describing the number of accidents he had and that he was getting dementia. If you go back and look at it, her eyes deviate from that baseline fairly significantly, as well as breaking contact.
I 100% agree. Her baseline has her doing recall of looking up into the corners. And when she broke, I don't know if you want to just maybe play this again in the final video, but when she broke this time, her eyes stayed towards the middle. They were still focused on an object that was off camera.
Here's another part of that episode where they're talking about another moment of Carol Baskin's interview.
Is that what you were talking about?
Right. Yeah, so she, instead of accessing, which would look, if my face isn't clear here, accessing would look more like this. And her eyes were just like this.
This idea that you can get reliable information about what someone is thinking or about their likelihood of deception is repeated by many people in a variety of iterations. It's even been taught in some law enforcement and interrogation trainings. A 2021 paper titled Investigative Interviewing Research and Practice includes information about the use of NLP-associated ideas in investigative work. Criminal investigators describe NLP as useful for developing rapport in an interview or interrogation, where the focus is on the interviewer matching an interviewee's nonverbal behavior, the manner in which they speak, and their choice of words. More often, NLP has been proposed as a way of helping an interrogator discern truth-telling from lying in criminal interviews and interrogations. Here, the focus is on an alleged relationship between eye movement and thought. For example, if right-handed people are visualizing an imagined event, i.e. something they're lying about, they are likely to look up to the right. If they are visualizing a remembered event, i.e. presumably something that they are not lying about, they are likely to look up and to their left, end quote. One example of this, a 2012 paper by the interrogation and interview consulting firm Wicklander Zelowski, was titled Misconceptions About Eye Movements, Part 2. In it, they described how noting person-specific patterns about which eye direction was linked to accessing memory can lead to hugely reliable deductions about someone deceiving or not. They describe an interrogation where a subject's eye movement patterns allowed them to conclude she was lying about denying using drugs on the job. They concluded that example by writing, "The subject's eye movements during this exchange helped in gaining an admission," end quote. Because these ideas are so common, it's understandable that many lay people think there's validity here. Many people will conclude, so many people are talking about this idea, there has to be some valid information there, right? It must be that eye direction gives us valuable clues to what people are thinking and whether they're lying or telling the truth, right? And yet, no, surprisingly, there is no evidence that one can use someone's eye direction to get useful information about what they're thinking about or deduce whether they're telling a lie or not. There's actually good evidence against that claim, as numerous studies have found no useful correlations. Now, to be clear, this is not to say there are not person-specific tells. People can have all sorts of idiosyncratic tells and patterns when it comes to behavior, and we're not talking about that. We're talking here about the idea that these eye direction ideas can be used for the general population, that there are common types of patterns that can be found amongst the general population that help us read them and get clues as to whether they're likely to be telling the truth. And again, there is no evidence for that idea. And if you disagree with me on this, I invite you to send me a message, as I will be doing a deeper dive on this topic in the future. Now, many people who spread these ideas are, I think, major bullshitters. Many of them are on the highly deceptive and unethical end of the spectrum. For example, you've got people like Chase Hughes, who claims to be an expert at behavior and influence, and whose immense amounts of deceptions and unethical behaviors I've examined in other episodes. Other people who spread these bad and low information ideas, I think, are true believers of various sorts. I would count Greg Hartley, also of the behavior panel, in the True Believer group. He and Chase's ideas on behavior are heavily influenced by NLP, and these ideas are commonly held by those who embrace NLP trainings, even though NLP ideas have been thoroughly debunked. Some people, like the Wicklander Zulowski organization I referenced, I think have done good work on interrogation patterns and strategies in other contexts. I actually interviewed David Zulowski when I first started this podcast, and I found it an interesting conversation, and it was one of my more popular episodes. I think some of these people have just made the mistake, as many in law enforcement and interrogation work have done, of defending some old, outdated, but still common ideas that just have no basis in evidence. This is just to say, my criticizing these ideas is not meant to imply that I think everyone who spreads the various forms of these ideas is purposely lying or being unethical. It's a spectrum, as with everything. But the behavior analysis space, especially the more pop behavior analysis space where people like the behavior panel make claims of frequently getting reliable information from assorted interviews and speeches, is full of bad information. The people in this space, and in NLP more broadly, have incentives to exaggerate what's possible with interpreting behavior. They can even have internal incentives to persuade themselves of some of these ideas. And it's easy to persuade ourselves of faulty ideas, especially when it involves an ambiguous and high variance information source like behavior. Later, I want to do a much deeper dive into this topic, as I've done a lot of research into it, and it does make for an interesting history of how these ideas came to prominence back in the 70s, and how NLP was involved in that, and why these ideas are still so popular, and the various iterations of these ideas from the more easily debunked to the harder to debunk. I've not seen anything like that deep dive elsewhere. If you'd like me to spend time working on that deeper dive, please let me know in the comments and send me a message, as the more encouragement I get, the more likely I'll be to work on it. But this episode will not be a deep dive in that way. It will be an interesting talk with deception detection researcher Tim Levine. Tim and I talk about the eye direction idea, and we talk about the huge amount of bullshit in the pop behavior analysis space, and some of the reasons the spreaders of that bullshit are so popular and successful. We talk about what the science says about using behavior to detect deception. We talk about why it's so difficult to use behavioral information to detect deception. We talk about the frequently heard idea that you need to establish baselines for people and that this will help you read them. We talk about poker tells and how behavioral patterns in games can differ from more real-world non-game scenarios. We talk about confirmation bias in the behavior analysis space and how even very smart researchers can fall prey to the mistake of being biased in favor of their own ideas. We talk about Paul Ekman and whether some of his teachings about behavior have gone awry due to his burning desire to prove his own theories. If you're interested in behavior or you just like debunking bullshit, you'll like this episode. This is actually my second talk with Tim Levine, and if you like this one, you should go back and listen to that one. In the first episode with Tim, we talk about his truth default theory, basically the idea that we will tend to believe people unless something triggers us and gives us a reason to not believe them. This helps explain why we can be so gullible about so many things, why it's so easy for us to fall prey to scammers and con artists, which, by the way, includes some of the same people out there who make grandiose claims about being able to teach you how to read and influence and manipulate people. You can learn more about Tim Levine at timothy-levine.squarespace.com or just Google his name. I'll read a little bit from his bio on his site. Levine has published more than 160 refereed journal articles reporting original research related to communication, and he is an internationally recognized leader in deception research. He is the author or co-author of Information Manipulation Theory, Truth Default Theory, The Veracity Effect, The Probing Effect, and the Park-Levine Probability Model. His research on deception has been funded by the National Science Foundation, the U.S. Department of Defense, and the FBI. His current research focuses on what makes some people more believable than others, the prevalence of lying, and on effective interrogation strategies. Levine's book, Duped, describes his program of research on deception relevant to truth default theory. In this talk with Tim, we focus mostly on the most extreme and easily debunked form of this I-direction idea, the idea that someone looking up and to their left is associated with real visual memory, and the idea that looking up and to one's right is associated with visual construction. That is still a common idea despite being so clearly false and debunked. But our talk also pertains to the more sophisticated version of these ideas. And I put sophisticated in quotes here. The idea that people will tend to have one of two patterns, looking one way for recall and the other for construction, and that you just have to figure out what someone's pattern is. I call that the more sophisticated version because it's harder to debunk and can come across like a more advanced and sophisticated version of the old, more clearly debunked idea. But again, there's just no evidence for that either. There are no studies supporting these ideas, even as so many speak as if they are extremely reliable. And that should be a red flag, as Tim and I talk about, when people act as if a behavioral pattern is highly reliable and contains a lot of information, and yet nothing has been found in studies on it despite people looking for it, and actual behavior researchers don't think it's legitimate. These are all red flags that there's likely a good amount of bullshit involved. Okay, here's the talk with Tim Levine. Hi, Tim. Thanks for joining me again.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, good to see you. So, maybe we can start with, you know, you've been in the deception research field for quite a while. I'm wondering if you can maybe give a synopsis of how, what your views are on the whole, like, neuro-linguistic programming associated idea of what quadrant you look in, upper left, upper right, that those things can be tied to, you know, somebody accessing their recall, making it more likely to be truth, or accessing their more creative side, making it more likely to be made up in a lie. You know, we see these ideas a lot. So I'm wondering if you have a rough summary of how you view those ideas in your many years in the field.
Were you intentionally looking up while you were talking to me?
No, I wasn't trying to do. Now you got me all.
What should I infer from that?
Yeah, now you got me. I'm going to be thinking about this too much now.
Oh, sorry to do that to you.
You got to do it. Got to throw it in there.
So I'm not in any way an expert on eye behavior as it relates to what people are thinking about. My area of expertise is all in deception. And to the extent that the neurolinguistic stuff and eye behavior is linked with truth and deception, then I can say with pretty good confidence that there doesn't seem to be any relationship at all between eye behavior of any sorts and whether or not people are honest or not.
So, yeah, and the surprising thing to me is, that's my understanding. I've looked at a good amount of research on this, debunking it. You know, there was the well-known one from 2012, Richard Wiseman debunking it, and some others. And I just keep seeing the idea, and it is really surprising to me because I hear people saying it quite confidently. Like, you know, for example, this guy on the behavior panel, Greg Hartley, will say, like, it's very tied to, you know, recall and very, very tied to deception, highly correlated. And it just kind of surprises me because I'm like, you would think if something was so highly correlated, they would have found something, a little something in the research. But, you know, so it sounds like, yeah, you have not heard of any research that stood out saying like there's something there in those terms.
No, and I have... So as part of my deception detection work, I've been collecting these videotapes of people. I bring participants into the lab, you know of this work, and give them a reason to lie. They're playing a trivia game and they get an opportunity to cheat. And it's up to them whether or not they cheat or not. But if they do, they might be in trouble because it's a university setting. And then we interview them about this. And I have 485 tapes. And out of that, there's one liar with the sort of up, right? So there might be people who do this. But it wouldn't ever show up in social science because most people don't. And even that one was an international student who was obviously speaking in second language. Hmm. And so it might have had nothing to do with the fact that she cheated in lying. And it might be that, the communication task was quite difficult for her. Mm-hmm. And I have met individuals who do... eye things when they're thinking. My wife does. My wife has a visual memory. And when she is recalling things, her eyes go up. But this isn't, you know, this is a thing that's unique to her.
Right.
And people have particular kind of eye behaviors and eye patterns. But I know of no evidence that those sorts of claims are general across people.
Right. I think that's like an important nuance because it's like, yeah, to tie it to my poker tells work, it's like there are poker tells that you can use that are pretty valuable and are not studied. Like there's no formal studies. So it wouldn't be surprising to me to learn that there were patterns that just haven't been studied or haven't been studied well. But then, and then there's also player specific patterns, right? Like that you wouldn't find in a general population. But for that first case, like it wouldn't shock me to learn that there was some kind of upper left, upper right general pattern. But like for the people that speak as if it's like a really highly correlated pattern, that's what gets me. It's like, it kind of clearly can't be that highly correlated a pattern if all these studies, multiple studies have not found anything. And for, you know, so I think that to me is the important part because like, yeah, sure, there could theoretically be something there, but if someone's talking as if like this is a very highly reliable clue to something related to deception, like that's to me where you get into like, you should really, red flags should really be waving, because that's, there's nothing supporting that. And if it was such a highly correlated thing, somebody would have found something by now. So that's kind of where I stand on it. It's like, it's not that I'm like skeptical of everything out there that somebody says, but I think it really, when some of these people speak in the really highly confident ways, that's what really bugs me. Cause I'm like, there's no way it can be, you know, highly correlated like that for a general population. But, yeah.
You know, I'm a pretty experienced researcher. And when things are highly correlated, if you've seen lots and lots and lots of data, it probably only takes about 20 people to see the pattern in a high correlation.
Highly correlated, yeah.
Right? And if I've done 400 something and I'm not seeing the pattern, right, then there's either it's a tiny correlation that might be real, but you only need big data to see it. Or it's not there. And either way, it's not going to be at all practically useful in any way.
Right.
Right. So I think we can really, really confidently, at least as related to deception, rule out the idea that there's a strong correlation there. I think, you know, just the way statistics work and, you know, yeah. If strong correlation was there, it would show up in data and yeah. It would show up across data sets. And yeah. It's very clear it doesn't.
Yeah, so that's, and I think that's a real important point too, a general point. I mean, a lot of these behavior studies that you find, or just maybe just research in general, they'll find a correlation, but it will be very weak, right? So it's like, even if there is a correlation there, the chances of it being like practically useful, even if it is there, which sometimes is in doubt if it's a really small, you know, small correlation, sometimes the research papers make it like, just if you read the research papers, it makes it sound like there's something that could be meaningful there. But a lot of the stuff, and I'm not even talking about deception, because that's, you know, that's a specific area too, but it just seems to me like sometimes the papers and then the way the media reports on it will make it sound like there's this like large correlation there, but you actually read the paper and it's like, oh, it was like, you know, a few percent more likely in this one scenario. But I'm curious if you have thoughts on that. Like, do you see that often happening in like science reporting for behavior related things where it exaggerates how much correlation is there?
Yes, absolutely. And I was writing about that just before we got on together.
Mm.
So one of the problems is that researchers rely on something called significance tests. And the way they're most often used is what they're being used to statistically rule out the idea that there's nothing there. And it's real easy, even if there's something there, right? If you can rule out nothing there, that means there's something there. But that there's something there doesn't mean that there's much there.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm teaching to my students, if I have a dime in my pocket, it means I'm not broke. I don't have zero money, right? But that dime's not going to take me very far. It's not going to buy me a cup of coffee or a beer or even a candy bar, right? And there's a big, big, big difference between having a dime and being a millionaire. So ruling out broke doesn't necessarily tell us much. In the context of deception, the latest data is that the best tell to deception has to do with the number of details in an account.
Hmm.
And on average, honest people provide more detailed accounts than people who are deceiving or lying. And this effect is somewhere between one-third of a standard deviation and half a standard deviation. So let's think about what that means. So if somebody gives a detailed account, does that mean that they're honest? No, of course not, right? And if somebody doesn't provide much details, But if you really wanted to use this in an instance, you would need to know what I would call a cut point. So how many details does it take before it proves that somebody's honest? Right? And the second you start to think about this, you realize how absolutely silly it is to take a statistical finding that occurs, you know, across a large number of people in very tightly controlled situation with all other things being equal, and try to apply it outside of that. For example, I don't have a visual memory. I mentioned earlier that my wife has an incredible, she's probably like one in a thousand, one in 10,000 visual memory people.
Right, you've got the aphantasia thing, which is, you know, which is how I would describe my own, and
But I have no visual memory. So I can't pull up. So if you're asking me to describe something visual, I'm not going to be able to provide, I give you gist, but I can't give you any details. This doesn't mean I'm lying. You know, now if you want to give me, if you want me to give you details about, you know, my latest study, then I can give you all kinds of details. And and if you're talking to me, I can give you a lot more details about like the last study I read than the average professor can about the last study they read. But I can't like tell you the the faces of the people in my classroom.
The level of detail, it might have a correlation, but it's not for all intents and purposes, it's not practically useful for practical,
purposes. Yeah, because what that correlation means is, right, all things being equal in a carefully controlled environment across large numbers of people. And just all bets are off in particular situations when there's other factors at play.
Yeah, the though to play devil's advocate, I can imagine, like if you were in a police interrogation scenario, I imagine outside of the lab, If it's like a consistent thing where somebody's not able to give you like pertinent details and when they're giving a report, I can imagine scenarios where you're like, you know, okay, well, this seems to make it significantly more likely based on this specific scenario that this person's, you know, making stuff up or telling a lie. But then I think the pertinent question, even if you think that, is like, what do you do about it? Because, and usually I think in interrogations, that's not going to be the only clue, right? Like you're not, I don't think it often happens where they're like basing a big decision based on like, you know, this guy left out some pertinent details. I think that's what gets left out is like, you know, investigators may have a feeling one way or the other, but like rarely is that like making up a, you know, a decision point of where they spend their time. Usually there's going to be some like other evidence involved or some reason to go down a path, right? They're not just like, he left out some details or other, some other behavior thing. And they're gonna like go down this path based on that. And I think that often gets left out. It's like in the big picture of things, all these things can be pretty minor, even if you think they are a factor. At least that's how I view it.
Exactly. And let's think about your particular example. So we got the detective is interviewing a suspect and listening for details. It probably matters a whole lot how long ago the thing was. Right. So I'm going to have a lot better memory of a recent event than a distant. And that's going to affect how detailed things are. It's going to matter how smart I am. If you're, you know, interviewing somebody who's two standard deviations above average versus somebody who's two standard deviations below average, you're going to get very, very different degrees of specificity.
There's all sorts of context. Yeah, there's all sorts of things in the mix of like whether somebody would judge this was abnormal or not.
Yeah, was this a typical thing or something that was really memorable?
Right.
What was their emotional state when this was going on? Right. There's so much in there that's going to affect how detailed you are or where your eyes are moving than just the fact that you're lying or telling the truth.
Yeah, we'll get back to the general behavior things, but to get back to the eye direction, do you have a sense of where those ideas come from? Because I get this rough sense that, you know, I think there is some evidence that looking up people generally like to look up when they're recalling things, because basically because it's like a clear field of vision and it's like a place that's not distracting. So you generally, people will naturally sometimes look up because it just is somewhere to look. I mean, so I can understand that part of it. And then I kind of understand where they, the NLP people got the left and right idea because of the left and right hemispheres, one being tied to more, you know, concrete things and one being tied to more creative things. So I kind of get that too. And then there's also these things where they're like, if you're looking in the middle sphere, it's more auditory. And they also have this thing, if you're looking down, it's more sense related, like tactile, which kind of makes sense because you'd be thinking about like your hands touching something. So I cut, you know, just to say, I can see where they got the ideas. At least that's my rough understanding. But I'm curious if you have your own thoughts on where those ideas might have come from or originated from.
I think a lot of ideas come from legitimate observations of people, where we don't realize how idiosyncratic the observations are, right? So we notice certain trends and we really notice them, mm-hmm. right? But then what we do is we over-generalize them.
Yeah,
over-extrapolate, over-generalize.
Right.
I don't think people appreciate just how different people are person to person. This is a huge problem in, let's say, like brain scanning, right? Because not everybody's brain works the same way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it makes sense. And the bias to, once you start thinking something is a clue, you're more likely to notice it. And I mean, I can see how that's, especially if you're not a scientist and you start having a theory about something and you're like, oh, it really seems to hold up, you know, but you're just biased and you're remembering, you know, like we all do for various things, we're just remembering the times it worked and the times and forgetting the times it didn't work, de-emphasizing the times it didn't work. But I can kind of see how that played into the NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, where those guys kind of thought they were geniuses, which I think the narcissistic element of some of this stuff, you know, kind of plays into like, oh, I have this theory that is going to make me, you know, show my genius. And they're really motivated to like find the evidence for it. And then they really start believing like, oh, this is so important, you know?
So I have these different categories of researchers. I think there's some researchers who are really all about the science, right? And they're trying to learn stuff. And for them, it doesn't matter about being right yourself, mm-hmm. right? It's about trying to
find the truth.
And if you're wrong, hey, you know, then, you know, you learn something too. Right. And there's no difference between whether you're right or wrong, as long as you learn something. Right. And even if you know you don't know, it's also an important thing of knowledge. Then there's researchers out there that are just playing a publication game to get tenure and get a job and to be good in the race pool. And for them, it's just kind of a thing they do.
It's a grind, yeah.
Yeah. And then there's a third kind of people, which I call the crusaders or the true believers. And some of them are very intent on being the genius and being right. Others of them have a particular cause. Right. And they don't want to let data stand in the way of either their brilliance or their cause. And so there's all kinds of tricks that researchers can play out of view to make their findings look supportive when they present them. And when somebody else tries to do the study, it doesn't come out. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then they have to like search for reasons why it didn't come out because they're really invested in the idea behind it, right?
Yeah, and they get into this circular logic that goes something like this. I'm right. If you find something that doesn't agree with me, it's because you didn't do your study right. I know you didn't do your study right because you didn't find what I know is right.
Right. Right. Yeah, this almost seems like a good idea for a studying researchers for the different types of, motivations and separating the ideology or something from the true questers for truth and such. Do you have thoughts? Are you willing to share how that maps over to some specific researchers in the behavior space? I mean, because I've heard let's take Paul Ekman, for example. Obviously he's done some good work, but I also have seen, criticisms that he is a bit too, set in some of these ideas, and that even when they turn out to not be true, they still, him and his, I think it's the Ekman Foundation or Institute or something, they still promote some of these ideas that are, that seem to be in question or have found not very useful. But I'm curious if you have any thoughts, whether it's on Ekman or anybody else, would you like to share thoughts about the behavior and or deception sphere at all?
I'm very likely to get into particular names, but I can say with Ekman that I've only kind of met him, seen him talk once in person. And when he did his presentation, he was very explicit that what he was trying to do was stick to his guns no matter what. And so I don't have any problem calling him out on this, because if I heard him correctly, this was self-classification in that camp.
And I've heard that criticism from other people. Yeah. So that doesn't surprise me.
I was kind of shocked that he would say it aloud. I thought that probably took a whole nother level of arrogance.
And maybe I can get the exact, was that a recorded thing or just something you heard?
It might have been. It was at the second Decepticon at Stanford.
Okay. Well, I could probably find something equivalent if I can't find that one, because I think I've heard people make that criticism. So, but maybe we can pivot to the, when it comes to the general behavior for use for deception, do you want to share any of your general thoughts about, how useful that is, or anything bugging you in that space that you've seen recently, anything like that?
I don't know so much recently, but there's this longstanding belief in the deception literature that there are these cues or tells to deception. And my reading of the whole literature, as this is pretty clearly been debunked.
I think that's what you and I talked about the first time.
And there absolutely are ways to detect deception, but it's not by reading people's cues. It's not by listening for details. So details are a great example. So the cue people all want to count up details. And if you're giving me a really detailed account, then you're probably honest. And if you seem to be avoiding details or can't bring them up, then you're probably lying. In my view, what you want to do is you want to listen for what the details are and see if you can fact check them. Right? So if you're giving me details that don't align with the truth as I know it.
Right. The actual evidence. Yeah.
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 So the point, and the deeper point, is usually in deception detection, we're not interested if somebody's lying or not. We want to know what the truth is. And then the question is, if what they're saying, once we know that it's not truthful, then we can ask ourselves, are they lying to us, or are they just misguided? I wonder some of this with modern politics. How much, when politicians are saying things that are truly false, and obviously false and easily fact-checkable and provable false, are they believing their own bullshit? Or are they, and being sincere in this falsehood, or are they just duping people? And of course, it might be a mix of both.
Right.
Right, but I think usually what we want to do is we want to know what's true. And, you know, it's only if I really have a relationship with you that I care. Are you being honest with me? Otherwise, it's good enough for me to know what's true or not.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point there, because, I mean, people can fool themselves into, you know, people often say things that they really believe that are clearly untrue. And actually, when it comes to, I mean, there's studies showing that people with more narcissistic personalities especially can convince themselves of things that are clearly not true, or you know, things that most people would say, like, that's not true. So it opens up this space where it's like, yeah, it's sometimes it's even hard to tell if someone is knowingly telling a lie, even when you know that they're telling saying something that's not true. So, I wanted to ask too, I think the devil's advocate response, or the people in the pop behavior kind of space who I often criticize, they often do this thing where they're like, well, you need to get the baseline. And if you have the baseline, you know, then you can tell deviations. So they might say, like, well, yeah, maybe it's not that valuable, but, once you study them for a while in the context of an interrogation or something. But to me, I think this is often just covering up for bullshit, because what they're really trying to do is have it both ways. They're trying to acknowledge that a lot of this, the behavioral cues stuff, isn't that useful, right? So they're saying, like, well, you got to check the baseline. But in any practical, you know, sense, like if you're studying some interrogation footage or some speech of somebody over time, like, you would have to rack up such a huge amount of baseline to, like, judge things like small behaviors or things like small verbal things. Like, you would have to rack up, you know, for all these things that happen pretty infrequently, like, But the way they talk about it in these kind of like pop behavior videos, they'll speak as if it's highly reliable, but then they'll occasionally be like, well, you got to check the baseline. But it's like, that's just, to me, is just a way to wave away the fact that these things are barely reliable, if they are reliable, even, like, because a lot of things they say are just like the eye direction thing. It's like, that's kind of clearly bullshit. And, like, yeah, so I'm curious what you think of all that, this whole, like, you got to get the baseline stuff.
So the baseline has been researched way more than the eye stuff. I mean, there's a lot of research on this dating back to one of my former professors, Jerry Miller, in the 1980s. And it is clear, baseline doesn't help much. I mean, best case scenario, it might move you from like 54% to 58%. But that's, I mean, that's best case.
Right.
Baselining doesn't help much. The argument I've heard against kind of the go with evidence and go with facts is, well, sometimes evidence and facts aren't there. And at least in a criminal context, my answer to that is, what are you doing interviewing people going in cold with no facts, right? Yeah. It's not like police pulling random people reason, right?
Just pulling a guy off the street, you know nothing about him. I got to go only on his vibes, you know?
Yeah, I can just see, like, the SEALs, you know, randomly going in and snatching up random people from
that's the really important part, because, like, it's like in almost any interrogation interview kind of setting, you're gonna have, like, there's a reason you're doing that, and you're looking for actual evidence. You're not just going in blind being like, he looked a certain way or did this thing, and therefore I'm gonna change the direction of my investigation based on this little thing he did, you know? Like, It's kind of leaving aside how these things actually work in the real world. Yeah. To mention a specific thing, like, I'm remembering the behavior panel, you know, one of their first ones, or actually their first one was analyzing the Tiger King. And so they were analyzing Carol Baskin's, you know, behavior, how she spoke and where she looked. And, you know, this is like a common thing. Them and other people in this space will be like, oh, you know, she deviated from her baseline there when she was answering that question. She looked a different way and she talked faster or whatever the thing is they say. But it's like, yeah, to reiterate that point, it's like, there's all sorts of reasons why she could be doing that. Like, it's a slightly more emotional thing. Her emotions changed. It's uncomfortable. She's thinking about whatever. Like, there's
a bird flies by.
Yeah, there's literally so many things. And to say like that ever could be meaningful, you would literally have to put Carol Baskin in and study her for like, you know, 100 hours or more to, you know, get a sense of like, what actually are her patterns and when does she deviate? And then that would even imply that you could even easily link like lies to, you know, which is itself hard to do. Like we said, like it's hard to tell lies from something someone has fooled themselves to believe, all these things. So there's just so much massive complexity, but that all gets waved away in these pop behavior analysis people's things where they're like, oh, well, you got to get the baseline, but still I'll speak as if this thing is highly valuable. And it's like, well, when is it valuable if you just said you had to get the baseline? How are you going to get that baseline? You know, so this is just what I mean. I'm trying to emphasize, like, there's just so much bullshit in this space.
There's
so,
it's so like, much bullshit.
It's wild to me. It's wild.
But there's a market for bullshit.
There really is.
There always has been.
Yeah, there really is.
Right? This is all through human history.
Yeah.
Right? There's been bullshit and there's been market for bullshit.
Yeah. What do you think explains the market, the demand for the behavior stuff specifically?
Wishful thinking, mostly.
Do you think it's
But wouldn't it be cool if it was true? I mean, yeah. What all of this almost always has in common is, wouldn't it be cool if it was true?
Mm-hmm. Do you think
it'd be really helpful?
Do you think there's a, I mean, the way I think of it is, it's almost like people want to have a special ability, like they're questing after, like, I'm one of the special ones that can recognize this stuff. And I mean, I see that in this, like the behavior panel Facebook page where the fans are like posting a video and they're like saying all this bullshit about what they think happened in this video. And it's just like, it's just their biases and their dislike of people coming out. And so they might hate some royalty member of the British royalty. So all their dislike, you know, they're filtering all these behaviors through their dislike of these people. And so they're just like, she moved her head that way. It shows she's a, you know, a filthy liar, blah, blah, blah. They like to embrace the idea that they've learned some interesting or powerful tool that is amongst the special set of people. But that's how it strikes me of why the demand for that is there. Yeah.
Well, in their defense, now I'll play devil's advocate.
Okay, I like that.
I think I have some special knowledge. Right? And I think it's kind of cool that I do. You know? And because I have the special knowledge, you know, you'll invite me onto this podcast. And there's like good stuff that happens when you have special knowledge. So I can understand why people,
why the demand
I think
is there.
That yeah. feels psychologically good.
It's a good, it's a good quest.
There's, you know, some advantages in life if you can convince other people that you have it.
Yeah.
Right? Nobody wants to go see the doctor who really doesn't know what they're doing. You know, but if they think you're the specialist who really is going to cure my cancer, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of people willing to pay big bucks for that.
Yeah. And I guess we would say how you approach the quest for special knowledge is important. You need to be hyper skeptical and not fall prey to the desire to have special knowledge quickly, basically, I would say. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to kind of A, work hard to get it, and B, be willing to have it put to independent tests.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, so if my ideas and my findings don't hold up when other labs look at them, you know, mm-hmm. then
I don't know if you want to get into this, but I think some people, and I talked about this in my last interview with you, but I don't know if you listened to it because I just added a note, but I was trying to tie in, because I think a lot of people would be surprised that me, who I've worked on,
you know, I was a former poker player. I wrote books on poker tells. A lot of people would be surprised that I agree with you that deception detection is like very hard with behavior, if not mostly impossible. But the clarification there is, I think poker tells, the ones that are useful, are not really about deception, because people think like bluffing is deception. But what usually happens, we're just talking about patterns that, you know, for example, there's different categories, but one category is people are just much more relaxed when they have a strong hand. I mean, that's one category, and that has nothing to do with deception, right? Like somebody making a big bet in poker and they're very relaxed, they just do things that a bluffer wouldn't do. A bluffer's more, you know, more tied down. And like, so a lot of the more relaxed behaviors from bettors are tied to, very highly correlated to, you know, having good hands. And that's one example. And then there's other examples of attention, like, you know, somebody like staring at their cards, for example. They people tend to not look at their strong cards long because they like to hide their power or their treasure, right? Which means that somebody that looks at their cards for a while tends to equal a weaker hand that they're just not that interested in. And that has nothing to do with deception detection either. It's just kind of an attentional thing, or like a desire to hide value when we have something good. So just to say, there's these classes of tells that are quite valuable. And I'm not the only one who thinks this. There's many experienced poker players who think these things, but these things have nothing to do with deception detection, right? So I think that's, I just want to throw that in there, because I think people would be surprised that I agree with you on the behavior and the deception front. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, or if you, anything comes to mind about the different, you know, these other categories of attention and so on. Yeah.
No, I think, you know, there are behavioral things. You know, we're more likely to smile when we're happy. You know.
Yeah, and a real smile really, that like affects our eyes, yeah, and these kinds of things. Yeah, there's all these, yeah, there are all these patterns, yeah.
Right, and yeah, when you're engaged, you know, the fact that we're having a good time talking to each other will be evident to anybody who watches this,
mm-hmm, yeah,
right? Because we're doing all this like engaged communication stuff.
Yeah,
this is a real thing, and this is how people act when they're
we're not hating this. You can get the read that we're not hating this interview.
No. This is like a good back and forth, and this is communicated in part nonverbally. So, you know, nonverbal stuff is pretty good at conveying emotions. People can seek to hide those, but generally speaking, you know, things like how engaged you are in the conversation, and do you like somebody or dislike them, or what are your major emotional states? Are you tired? Are you energized? These things come off, and they're real things. It you just got to be really, really careful in reading them. To use your poker example, and you would know much more about this than me, but my guess is the elite players know this stuff.
Yep.
And that these things are going to be much more useful on less elite players than more, yes, elite players.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's do you have anything else you want to fit in here while we're on the call? Do you think I know we've covered the things I want to cover. I don't know if you want to say anything else about the eye direction things that we haven't talked about, anything else?
No, it was just a blast. It was fun talking to you again. It's been a while. How long ago was it?
Oh, that was like a couple years. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a while back. But yeah, I want to, yeah, anybody listening, go check out the first interview, because that was, I don't know if I ever told you, that was one of the more popular episodes of the podcast, I think, because people search, you know, it was just a term that people search, deception and things like that. But yeah, I think people really like that one.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to be on with you again. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Tim.
And reaching out.
All right. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Okay. That was a talk with Tim Levine, deception detection researcher. Just a reminder that I have another talk with Tim, and that one was one of my more popular episodes. You can learn more about Tim at his website, timothylevine.squarespace.com. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. If you like this podcast, please hit subscribe on the platform you listen on. If you appreciate my work, consider going to buymeacoffee.com/Zach Elwood. That's ZACHELWOOD. And sending me a gift to encourage me to spend more time on this podcast. You can learn more about this podcast at behavior-podcast.com and find various compilations of episodes on specific topics like mental health, tells and games and sports, and more. Thanks for watching. Music by Small Skies.